pleased to have Professor Belinda Wilkes with us. She's going to speak on a clear view of the X-ray universe with NASA's Chandra X-ray Observatory. It's part of this series, so I know she's going to speak mainly on her science, but I hope she gives some sort of flavour of how her faith interacts with her science. A little bit about Belinda. She's a Royal Society Wolfson Visiting Fellow at the School of Physics here in University of Bristol. She recently retired as a senior astrophysicist at the Center for Astrophysics of Harvard and Smithsonian. Is that right? Harvard and Smithsonian, yes. Cambridge, Massachusetts, where she served as the director of the Chandra X-ray Center, which operates the NASA's Chandra X-ray Observatory. She is a fellow of the Royal Astronomical Society, the American Astronomical Society, the American Physical Society, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and the Cambridge Philosophical Society, and a member of the International Astronomical Union and the European Astronomical Society. That's pretty impressive. She has an extensive publication record and given numerous interviews in the public media. And just to cap it off, she's received numerous awards, including the NASA Outstanding Public Leadership Medal, 5 NASA Group Achievement Awards, and a NASA MSFC Director's Commendation, and many Smithsonian Institutional Exceptional Accomplishment Awards. So we're very privileged to have her. Just like to pray for us before Belinda comes to speak. So Heavenly Father, the psalmist says, "The heavens declare the glory of the Lord." And we pray that tonight, as we look into the amazing cosmos that you have created, we'll be really astounded by your creator, your created workmanship, and learn a little more about what it means to be involved in this sort of work as a Christian. We pray in Christ's name. Amen.
Okay, so I'm going to open with talking a little bit about my faith and then go mostly into science. I was born a Church of England Christian. I say Church of England because I was in the States for a long time. So I was born that way. And I always have been a Christian. And so while my attendance regularity has varied over the years, depending on the time of life, the church has always been a part of my life. I attended mother and children services with my mother, obviously, as a child, and my siblings. Sunday school, sang in the choir. I questioned, I suppose, the style of the services as a young person, and went through a Christian Union phase when I was in high school. I was in a youth group that had a band, which was great fun. They used to sing the Jesus Rock. They were actually very good rock band. And also into my college years, the Christian Union at St. Andrews, where I was an undergraduate. And I then changed countries, moved around the US. But I always came back to the Anglican Church, and I was a regular churchgoer in the US at the Episcopal Church, both in Massachusetts and in New Hampshire. I used to go a little bit when I was first there in Tucson, Arizona. I was just there for 2 years, but I wasn't quite as regular at that time in my life. So, and in particular, when my husband Bob, who's over here, and I arrived in Bristol, we immediately went to St. Paul's Church in Clifton because we were staying in Clifton Village and it was the nearest church, and we never left. We're still going there. We were welcomed with open arms by lots of different people, including Joan, for example, who's in the audience here today. And it's just our home now, or our second home, I suppose. We don't sleep there. I love the church building. There aren't that many big old churches in the US. Though in the Boston area, there are a few, which are very nice. The fact that there was music, the University Church Choir sings there, so that was great. And we were beginning to come out of the pandemic, so they were actually singing by the time we arrived in Bristol. The service was traditional service, which again, I've been starved of in a sense. The Episcopal Church service is a little different. It's based on a similar prayer book, but it's nice to come back to what I'm used to. The sermon was amazing. So yeah, we were sold. We thought we'd do a tour of churches before we settled down, but we didn't. We just settled down right there. And we go to Cotton regularly as well, which is part of the benefice, which is also a wonderful place. So, but as well as being a Christian, I'm also a scientist, as you've gathered, through and through. I like to understand how things work, why things are the way they are. I can't answer a question with a simple answer, but have to define the parameters which justify and qualify my answer. This drives my poor husband to distraction at times, probably more than just a few times, actually. Being both a scientist and a Christian has always been the case for me, and I've never seen a conflict between them. And so when I first went to the States, there was clearly a conflict there. I didn't think there was one here, but I guess nowadays there is. But I've never seen a conflict. To me, they're just inexplicably and completely intertwined. I mean, I love the universe, I love nature, I love God. They're all part of the same picture as far as I'm concerned. To quote from a sermon that Ginny Royston gave a few weeks ago, I love this phrase. She said, she opened with, "The beauty of being human is that we can find God in a myriad of ways." I think that's a beautiful way to think about God, think about being human, and think about the world we live in. God is everywhere. He's in everything. We only have to open our eyes and our hearts to the beauty around us and the wonder of a close friendship to find him, her, them in us and with us. As we learn more and more through our scientific studies, I know some people feel threatened. To me, it just means God is bigger and bigger. Everything we learn, he has to have been bigger to have made it. So I think it's incredibly great. The more we learn, the bigger he is. So you see where I'm going with this. Being an astrophysicist, I will show you even more ways to find God and the beauty of creation through views of the universe and tales of how it continues to surprise, challenge, and enthrall as we look more and more, bigger telescopes, more wavelengths, etc. So what you're looking at here is a very accurate rendition of NASA's Chandra X-ray Observatory, which was launched in 1999. This particular image, though, was made to celebrate its 20th anniversary in 2019. So Chandra's been up there now for it's in its 23rd year of operation, if I've got that correct. Still going strong. It was originally designed to be to operate for 5 years. Still going strong. But they always build these things for as well as they possibly can, right, to last as long as they can. Hubble is even older and is still going. Chandra is really Hubble's X-ray sister. It's part of the great observatories of NASA. And so I'll show you the great observatories here. Hubble, or HST, is this one here. And this is Chandra. At the bottom, I'm showing you a wavelength scale, going from very high energy on the left to very low energy radio on the right. And in the middle here, we have the visible light spectrum that we can see with our eyes. So this is all light with different wavelengths, or the electromagnetic spectrum. Above it, there's a thermometer, which shows the temperature at which material, matter, has to be to emit in that wave band if it's thermal emission, so like the coals in your barbecue. So if we look at the visible light, these are the temperatures that we're used to, though it's a Kelvin scale. If we look in the infrared, it's lower energy, and if we look in the X-ray, it's much, much hotter. So X-ray is sort of 10 million degrees. And gamma rays are even another, it's 10 billion degrees. I think billion is not used the same way here as in the US. In the US, it's just adding 3 more zeros. For clarity. Okay, so that is if we have thermal emission. So if you think of your barbecue grill, you heat up your coals, they start out sort of glowing red, so they're in the red part of the spectrum, the infrared part of the spectrum, and by the time they're white hot, they're hot enough to cook on. So that's moving to the left on this scale over here, just for the people here who are not scientists. I'm sure there are some. These are NASA. So in order to look at a source in the universe and understand what it's all about, you really have to look in multiple wavelengths. And one way to illustrate this is if you had an elephant and all you could see was its tail, you wouldn't have any clue what that elephant looked like. You need to look at the front, see the trunk. You need to see the middle of the back to see how big it is. So the same is true of celestial sources. If you only look invisible light, you only see things that are bright and visible light, and B, you don't see the rest of the spectrum. So you only see the emission that's coming out in the visible part of the spectrum. You don't see the radio, you don't see the gamma rays. So this is why we have many telescopes, and in particular, NASA's great observatories were designed to cover quite a wide range. So Hubble covers the visible light and also into the UV, the ultraviolet, which our eyes cannot see. Whoops, I'll go to that in a minute. That was the first to go up. The second was the Cosmic Gamma Ray Observatory, CGRO, which is no longer operating. It actually came down into the South China Sea probably about 15 years ago now. But we have another gamma ray telescope called Fermi that was launched in 2008. And so we work with that one now. It's still working very well. And you'll hear a bit more about that later. And then Chandra came along in 1999, looks in the X-rays. And Spitzer came along about 5 years after us. And Spitzer looked in the mid to far infrared. Not very far infrared, but mid infrared. Spitzer is no longer operating. It was actually in a solar orbit, and infrared detectors need to be kept at a certain temperature, so it had a coolant on board, and it ran out of coolant. It then could still operate for a few years on a couple of their bands, but now it's been turned off. It's actually too far away from us because it's going around the sun to be in touch with it very much anymore. But it's been a great partner to us as well. Okay, so those are the great observatories. Today I'm going to concentrate on Chandra because that's the one I worked with, but a lot of the pictures I show you, the images I show you, will be multi-wavelength pictures, and we'll color code the light so you can look at the emission from the X-ray compared with the emission from the optical, for example. Okay, Chandra was launched on the shuttle Columbia on the 23rd of July in 1999. And we're just going to watch the launch video because it's kind of fun to do. Has anyone ever been to a launch, actually physically? Because if you ever get a chance, I recommend it. This is the only one I've been to, but we were 3 miles away, and it was at night, as you can actually see. It's about 1:30 in the morning. This was launched on its third attempt because we had a couple of problems the previous two. And the whole ground shakes under your feet. And it's as light as day for 5 or 10 seconds, and then gradually fades, and you sort of see it arc over you as it goes up. It's really an amazing experience. First of all, to realize how much power it takes to overcome Earth's gravity, which is what you're doing when you go into orbit. And secondly, that we little humans can do this, that we can send rockets up into space. In fact, we just sent one back to the moon this week. So that was launch. There were a few problems on launch. I won't go into that, but they did get up there safely, but they were a few miles too low. There was a leak in one of the engines, fuel leak. So they were a few miles too low. And the engineers that worked for TRW, who were professional launchers of spacecraft, not us astronomers, they were back in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where our operations control center is. And they had to recalculate all the firings of our engines to get to our final orbit because we were starting from another place. But they know how to do that, and they were ready. The first job that these astronauts had when they got up into orbit was to let go of Chandra because it had a lot of fuel on board, and if anything had gone wrong, it could have blown up the whole shuttle. So they usually go up and then have a rest because it's quite strenuous to go through a launch. But in our case, they had to then release Chandra as soon as they got up there. And the next slide will show that happening. Our mission specialist, Katie Coleman, is hovering at the window, taking this movie of Chandra as the shuttle backs away from Chandra. And I'll let it go for a little while. There were 5 astronauts. I'll show you a picture of them later, but another important record that was obtained with this launch was that the first female commander of a shuttle mission, Eileen Collins, was our commander. And we're actually still in touch with the astronauts, as you'll see at the end. They come back and visit us every now and then, which is really neat. So this is Chandra, well, the shuttle moving away from Chandra. Now let it go. It's floating around because she's floating. There you can see the size of the satellite. It was actually the biggest load that any shuttle had taken up. It's even bigger than Hubble in terms of weight and size. And Columbia was the only one that could take it up. Okay, so it didn't stay in its initial shuttle orbit. The Hubble Space Telescope is in the shuttle orbit. It goes around the Earth about every 1.5 hours. And that's indicated with the green circle here. But over 2 weeks from that launch from the shuttle, we had our own rockets that we fired, both at perigee and at apogee, to change mostly the apogee, to raise that so that we end up going about a third of the way to the moon. So to do these firings in order to change the orbit, as you see. We come back into the radiation zones as well. So if we go to the next slide, on the right here, I'm showing the moon's orbit. It's a little cut off just because the picture's cut off. The Earth with the radiation belts around it. So the Earth is a blue and white spot. The radiation belts are in red. And Chandra seems to just have a mind of its own when I do this. Chandra orbit is right here. So it goes about a third of the way to the moon. It's about 3 days long, very stable. The orbit has moved around a bit, but the period is very stable. And on the left, we're zooming in to see that for part of the orbit, we come into the radiation belts, and we have to close down the instruments at that time because the radiation will damage them. But the orbit is 3 days long, and we only lose about 16 hours of time to that shutdown because it goes faster when it's going through the perigee. So it can observe, in theory, when it first went up, it could observe for a long time on a single source, where Hubble, for example, cannot because it keeps going around the Earth every hour and a half. It can only look at a source usually for about 60 or 70 minutes before the source is behind the Earth. So that's good for variable sources. It's also good in the X-rays. You have to sit on a source for quite a long time to get a lot of counts. Our counts have a lot of energy, but there aren't as many of them. Okay, so in case you're not familiar with how X-ray telescopes work, I'll just go through that quickly. This here shows the light path of a normal telescope, a visible light telescope, where we have a mirror. The light is coming in from the left, parallel beam, which is light from a star or anything at a great distance, basically comes in parallel, hits the mirror and comes back to a focus here. We're used to this. We can stand in front of a mirror and see the reflection of ourselves in it. That wouldn't work for an X-ray. It would just go straight through the mirror. They wouldn't even see that it was there because of the energy that the X-rays have. And we know that because doctors use them, medical doctors, to take X-rays of our arm if we break it, for example, because it can see through the arm. So how do we focus them? Well, it's called grazing incidence. So we have to have, instead of the light coming straight onto the mirror, it has to come at a very shallow angle. It's in the case of Chandra, it's between 1 and 3 degrees. We have 4 different sets of mirrors, as you'll see in a minute. But this shows the principle. So the incoming X-rays come in parallel. They hit 2 different mirrors, a paraboloid and then a hyperboloid, and then they're focused at the focal point, which is actually 10 meters away. So this isn't an accurate rendition. It just shows you a schematic of what's happening. And that's how you focus the X-rays. Chandra has taken a major step forward in focusing X-rays in that the resolution is about half an arc second, which is comparable with a ground-based telescope on a clear night, if you don't have active optics, which some of you may have heard of. So that was for the first time. It's an order of magnitude better than anything that had come before. It's also an order of magnitude better than anything that's planned to come in the future. So we're hoping it'll keep going for a long time because we won't be replacing it for a while. So this is the light path through Chandra, a schematic of Chandra itself. So the light, the orange dashes of the light coming in, for the X-ray light, coming in from a source, from a very distant source. They the mirrors are right here at the top. They hit the two pieces of the mirror, the paraboloid and the hyperboloid, and then 10 meters away, they hit the detectors here. And the main detectors we use are CCDs, which are specially designed to be able to detect X-rays. And we actually detect not just the position that each photon comes in, but its energy and the time it arrived. So we can do timing studies and spectral studies as well as imaging studies with one data set, if we get enough photons. Going back to the mirrors, this is what they look like. So this is zooming in on the mirror structures themselves, but cut away so you can see. They're actually almost like cylinders, though they are actually very accurately shaped for the shape they need to have. And there are four nested pairs. We only collect the X-rays that actually hit the mirrors. There are plenty of X-rays going through that don't hit the mirrors, and we don't collect those. You might also notice that there are gaps here. It was originally designed with six, that they were equally spaced, and at some point NASA cut back the budget. And so we got rid of two of them, but we wanted to still have the same energy range and resolution, so we kept the smallest and the largest and two of the ones in the middle. So that's the story of why we have gaps. All right, so I mentioned that this is the best telescope in terms of imaging that's in X-rays that has ever been. And so I'm showing you here the Orion star-forming region in the X-rays. Now, those of you who are amateur astronomers or even not will have seen the Orion Nebula, probably. It's in the dagger off Orion's belt. And you can see that the middle star, what looks like a star if you just stare at it, if you look slightly away, you'll see that it's fuzzy. And that is what this is. And of course, you're looking at the visible light from it. And here we're looking at the X-rays. It's called the star-forming region. There is a lot of gas and dust and enough gravity to pull some of that gas and dust together and form stars. Here, we're seeing the best picture that we had at that time, 250 sources. But right in the middle, there are so many stars crowded together in a small space that it's what we call confusion limited. We can't see the individual stars. They blend into each other. So it's a bit like looking at a tree from a distance. It just looks like a green blob. It's only when you get close you can see the individual leaves. So this is confusion limited. We had 250 sources, and that was a great step forward at that time. This was in the early 90s with the Rosat satellite, which was a UK, USA, Germany collaboration, which I worked on actually before I worked on Chandra. So what does it look like with Chandra? At least an order of magnitude improvement. Isn't that amazing? I love watching that. So this, we now have 1,400 sources, and we're resolving even around these very bright ones in the middle, which look big just because we're going to the edge of what's called the point spread function. Because they're very bright, we see the wings of this point spread function. But in these wings, you can see little tiny dots as well that are nearby stars. The color coding is based on the energy in the X-rays. So the blue ones are the highest energy, just like in a rainbow. The UV light, the blue light, is the highest energy optical light. And the red ones are the lowest energy. So this is what I meant by being able to measure the energy of the photons as well. Young stars, it turns out, that are very unstable and violent places. You've got gas trying to fall in because of gravity. It gets in each other's way. It gets very hot. Some of it gets blown out again in jets and winds. So it's very violent and unstable and gives us lots of X-rays. And it turns out that Chandra is a really good instrument for finding all these young stars. And I'm going to add the, I think this is a Hubble image here, of all the gas and dust around those stars. And you'll see why it's quite hard to see stars on the backside of this nebula, for example. In the visible, you can't see through that gas and dust. You only see the ones on this side before you've looked through too much gas and dust. With the X-rays, you can see all the way through. So you find all these young stars that have just become stars, and they're very hot and giving us lots of X-rays. So we've been able to study a lot about the formation and evolution of young stars in different star clusters as a result of studying them with Chandra, but also in comparison with the Hubble data and the Spitzer data as well, so that we find out everything about them. But where else do X-rays come from? They come from the hottest and most violent places in the universe. So things like stars being born, we just talked about, stars that are interacting, stars that are merging, black holes of any size, stellar mass black holes, supermassive black holes, as long as they're accreting material, which quite a few of them are, because if gas comes too close, it'll get sucked in because of the gravity of the black hole. And galaxies have a lot of very hot gas, which can only be seen in the X-rays. It's so hot that you don't see it even in the optical UV. You only see it in the X-rays. And we didn't really know it was there until we could see it with Chandra, well, with an X-ray observatory. But we also see X-rays from planets because our planets are nearby. In particular, for example, Jupiter. This is a picture from the Juno mission in the optical and UV of the, well, it's just two different angles of Jupiter. And the purple is the North Pole and the South Pole, and we're seeing X-ray aurorae on Jupiter, just like the aurorae on Earth. The difference is, though, that Jupiter actually has quite a strong magnetic field, and it also has an equatorial plasma ring. And so the magnetic field just takes those charged particles, plasma means it's charged ionized medium, takes the charged particles and streams them up to the north and south poles, and so you see X-rays coming from there. You also see optical and UV light, and we're observing it in coordination with Juno to get this observation. So most types of celestial sources do emit X-rays at some point during their life. Why do we need so many telescopes? Well, I did talk about this at the beginning. In order to see all the parts of a celestial source, you need to look in multiple wavelengths. But here's a really good example. Whoops, sorry. Mustn't touch that in that way. All right, so let's look at the right-hand side first. This is what we call an active galaxy, and I'll be talking about more of these later. It's a galaxy that has a supermassive black hole in its core, in its nucleus, and it's sucking in a lot of material and gets very hot, like a young star, but on a much, much bigger scale, and we see lots of X-rays. So we also see other things. At the bottom here, we have, it's the optical picture, visible light. It's an elliptical galaxy. It has a big dust lane across it, so you actually don't see the center very well. If you look in the radio, you see nothing like that. You see a jet and lobes, and those are charged particles moving along magnetic field lines in the two directions, away from the supermassive black hole in the middle and creating jets. And as that jet interacts with the material around it, it slows down, blows back, and you get what's called this double lobe structure. At the top, we have the X-rays, and we again color-coded it in terms of the energy of the X-rays. So the cooler ones are the red coming from the galaxy itself. The white hot is part of the jet. And then there's also X-ray emission coming from the ends of the jets, the lobes here as well. And this picture puts them all together and adds a star field. Well, the star field is also in the optical picture as well. The star field is just the stars that are around it, not necessarily involved with it at all. This is a huge galaxy quite a long way away, so most of those will be stars in our galaxy. So if we didn't have all these observations, we wouldn't know about some of these components of this incredibly exciting source. This is called an active galaxy, or a radio loud active galaxy, because it has these radio jets. Okay, I'm going to come back closer to home. That one was a long way away. To supernova remnants, so into our own galaxy. So when a massive star, much more massive than our sun, runs out of fuel, it blows up. Now, the reason for this is, if you think about an equilibrium star like our sun, it has gravity holding it together, and it's creating radiation. It's this fusion in the core that creates radiation that comes out, and it balances, the radiation pressure of the radiation moving out balances the gravity. And it's in a stable place, and it'll stay there for many, many giga years, our sun, because it's not particularly massive. Massive stars do the same thing, but they evolve much more quickly. And when they do things because they're big, they're more violent. So when they run out of material in the center to fuse, so the central core becomes mostly iron, which cannot fuse to anything heavier, that means that there's less radiation coming out, so gravity starts winning. So the core collapses, and as a result, it creates these shock waves through the rest of the star, and they all move out in a big explosion. And a supernova, this is called a supernova, and it shines as brightly as the 100 billion stars in its galaxy for a few days. That's how much power you get out of an exploding star. This describes what, I should probably have put this up first, this describes what I just did with my hands. You've got a star where the gravity is winning, the core collapses, it creates this shock wave that pushes the outer regions of the star out, and it leaves a stellar remnant in the middle there. And that sits there, keeps expanding for a long time. I also should state that heavy elements, which astronomers mean by that, anything heavier than helium. So hydrogen and helium aren't heavy, but everything else is a heavy element. Okay, heavy elements are created primarily in the cores of stars, because that's what fusion does. It creates heavier and heavier elements. They aren't just made in a random place in the universe. So when the supernova blows up, those heavy elements are then distributed, and they can then be sucked into another star-forming region and form another generation of stars and planets. And that generation will have heavy elements in it to begin with. Now, heavy elements are what we are made of. So the atoms in our bodies and all around us were born in the core of a star many, many giga-years ago, perhaps. So we are actually made of stardust. It's a strange feeling, isn't it? That makes you think, there must be a God out there, right? Okay, so the first source we looked at, the official first light picture, was a supernova remnant. We knew they'd look pretty nice because in ROSAT they'd look pretty nice. This is called Cassiopeia A. It's about 300 years old and about 30 light years across. And this was the first picture we took, and it was sent to the press and showed, you know, that Chandra is working. And it's beautiful. And again, the color coding is to do with the energy of the electrons, the energy of the light, X-rays. And with this first image, we discovered the stellar remnant, which is a neutron star. Usually, when a star blows up, you end up with a neutron star. A neutron star is a very, very dense star. If our sun was a neutron star, it would probably be about the size of a marble. It's hard to imagine. Very, very dense. And the only thing that holds it up is the inter-neutron forces, which stop it collapsing any further. And if it gets bigger than a certain mass, even those forces are overcome, and that's when you get the black hole, which just keeps collapsing forever because gravity is the only force left. Anyway, we found this remnant for this supernova remnant, which hadn't been seen before, and that's one of the things Chandra's been doing, is finding the remnants. And for the same reason as we could see the stars, the young stars in that star-forming region, with the X-rays, we can look through all that material that's coming out in all directions, so it's in our way. We can't see the center very well, but we can see it in the X-rays, so we're able to find these. This one is not a pulsar. Pulsars are neutron stars that vary very rapidly. This one is not varying, but it is a neutron star. Then we looked at it for longer. This is a megasecond, which is about 12 days. We didn't do it all at once. We looked at it every now and then. But see how much sharper all that structure is now. We can really begin to model how this star blew up by seeing where everything is. And going to the next slide, this is the same image on the left. I'm adding the optical light image from a ground-based telescope on the right. And you can see the structure here, and there's a lot of stars in your way, but they're not related. It's the same structure, but there's nowhere near as much emission. This is a very young supernova remnant, so it's very, very hot still, and mostly emits in the X-rays. But it's very useful to also get the optical light, because when we see where the cooler material is and we can understand the physical conditions in different places in that source by looking at the combination. This is the spectrum that we get from this supernova remnant. The shape of it is just the shape of the responsivity of the instrument, so it's more sensitive here. But the color coding is the same, so the blue here and the red here are the same in terms of energy as on the left. And we see emission lines that are characteristic of certain elements. Keep hitting the wrong button. So for example, this is silicon in green. And if you look carefully, you'll see silicon here. So there's, while it's mostly a spherical expansion, there's also been a jet, which there's a counter jet as well, where the material has come out more quickly. And you can become observers here. In the red, the lower energy, we've got this very strong iron feature. And the iron was in the core of the star, but some of it is now right in the outer part of this expanding nebula, expanding remnant. So somehow the iron has gone faster than the other materials, and it's right out the edge now. If you've got sharp eyes, you're going to say, "Ah, but Belinda, there's blue light further out." That's true. You can see the blue light over here. This, however, is not thermal emission. It's not because something's hot. It's what we call non-thermal. The opposite of thermal is non-thermal. We're very straightforward in astronomy. This is charged particles rapidly moving around magnetic fields and creating what we call synchrotron radiation. And this had been known in the radio observations of supernova remnants before, but we didn't know that that we were getting synchrotron radiation in the X-ray as well until we looked at this image. Sorry, go back. So things we can look at, we can look at how it exploded. Theoretical astronomers like that, and they can try and model it. We can find the neutron stars, and we've also seen this one expand, and that's what this one that keeps popping up and trying to show you. This is observations taken over about 13 years and just put in a sequence. And you can see the outer parts moving out, these structures changing. Some of these will be coming towards us, of course. So the blue emission here is coming towards us. It's still on the outer part. But the structure's changing. So more fodder for the modelers to try to understand how this stuff's moving. So they're really beautiful pictures, and they're really... it's really great data to understand what's going on. Here are some more. The one on the left is the Crab Nebula, which many of you may have heard of. It was the first pulsar that was discovered, and it was called the Little Green Man because man, and they would have been men in those days mostly, couldn't imagine that a universe could create something that would be able to repeat just very, very exactly on millisecond timescales. Not that we knew how to create it, but it had to have been intelligent life. Wrong. Wrong. You can see this one changes as well. So I'll go back. Here we are. This changes as well. It looks like a spinning top. It's actually not spinning. It has jets coming out, and it has material sitting around it, which is all non-thermal emission, in this case called a pulsar wind nebula, because the pulsar has a lot of strong magnetic field. And you're just seeing like waves go through the standing wave. This one's a bit like the spherical, a bit like Cassay. So is this one. We've also seen this one expand. And then this is another pulsar wind nebula, and this is a mess. It's obviously mostly exploded in that direction, but still a little bit in this direction. And there's a pulsar wind nebula in the middle. And the red is cooler material and probably a lot of iron again. Okay, so that's enough on supernova remnants. I'm going to go a lot further away now and talk about supermassive black holes, which is what I work on, in galaxies. So quasars are galaxies that have a supermassive black hole in their core. Now, we think all galaxies do have a supermassive black hole in the core, even the Milky Way. But in this case, they're actively accreting a lot of material from around them. That material gets incredibly hot and very, very bright, and outshines the whole galaxy. So, what was it I said? 10 to the 11, 100 billion stars aren't as bright as this core, this nucleus. where the supermassive black hole is. That means that we can see them a long way away, so we actually use them for cosmology, to study the structure of the universe as well. I study the quasars themselves, and I mostly study radio ones. And on the right here, this is a jet, there's the quasar, a radio jet going in two directions. This one's coming towards us, so you actually see the jet. Hot spots where it hits material around it, and then that material gets sort of distributed backwards and you get the lobes. So very similar to Centaurus A that I showed you earlier. This is called Cygnus A, and it's just a classic, beautiful, but fairly nearby, so we see the structure very well. What we call radio loud quasar or double lobed radio source. On the left is a schematic of, that's real data, by the way. This is real radio data from the Very Large Array in New Mexico. On the left is a schematic. We have in the center this very bright accretion disk, we call it, around the supermassive black hole. Around that, as you move further away, the material gets cooler, but we're pretty sure that it has a sort of torus-like structure. We have jets, particularly in the radio loud ones, coming from the poles of the accreting supermassive black hole. And in this case, we're almost edge on, so it's actually quite hard to see the bright core if you look edge on. If you look face on, it's incredibly bright, and you might have a jet coming towards you, and it looks even brighter in that case. This actually is what's called a selection effect. You don't see the edge on ones very well. We don't have as many of them because they're harder to find. Anyway, the supermassive black holes are anywhere from a million to a billion or 10 billion solar masses. Very, very big. Very, very massive. Quite small, really. All right, the first targeted source. So this is the source we looked at when we first turned on the telescope and we needed to focus. We all know about focusing on whatever we're using, microscope or binoculars or telescopes of our own. So we went to a quasar because, as I said, it has this very bright core and it outshines everything else. It's always a point source. Like a star is always a point source. You can't resolve the disk of a star. They're too far away. And if you look up in the sky and you see something that isn't twinkling, you know it's not a star, it's a planet, because then you can resolve it. And the different pieces of the planet's surface twinkle differently so it looks steady. My son learned that when he was very little, having two astronomers as parents. And he was at Cub Scouts camp. And so this Cub Scout person was doing an astronomy night. So there's a star. And he said, no, it's not a star. It's a planet. And the guy was so upset. It was pretty funny. Okay. I don't think he learned an awful lot more of astronomy. He's not doing that now, but he knows what a star is and what a planet is. So we looked at the point source. It's a quasar. It's far away. It's 9 gigalight years away. So for sure, we wouldn't be able to see anything around it. It's in the southern hemisphere. It's a Parkes radio source. This is what it looks like. This actually isn't the first picture. We went back and looked at it again. But on the quasar is the bright spot here. It is a single point source, but again, as I said, because of the point spread function, it looks bigger. But become observers again and have a look. This is in the X-rays with Chandra. What's this on this western? This is the western side. There's extra X-rays there that we weren't expecting. And the people in the control room were quite worried. They thought maybe there was something wrong with the telescope. Maybe one of the mirrors was misaligned or something was sitting in the beam and scattering off some of the X-rays to the side. They were trying to explain this feature that they weren't expecting. They couldn't find a good explanation. It's incredibly linear and narrow, actually. And then one of the people in the room was a collaborator of mine. We'd actually worked on this source with the previous X-ray satellite. We didn't know it had an X-ray jet because the resolution wasn't there. But he said, oh, it's a radio loud quasar. It has a jet. Let's see where the jet is. And sure enough, the radio jet is here. And we had discovered, just in trying to focus our telescope, X-rays coming from a radio jet, which we had hints of before, but we weren't really expecting to see. This one is 250 light years long, 9 arc seconds on the sky. So it's quite a lot. I'm going to combine it with the radio here now. So the X-ray is here, shown in a slightly different way with contours around it. the white is the center. This is the quasar itself, and you're just looking at the point spread function. But on this side, we have this extended region. Below is the radio data, which is much higher resolution because they use arrays of telescopes that cover a large range of space, and so they can get a much better position for anything than we can at shorter wavelengths. So the radio jet sits right where the X-rays are. It's on the same scale. This is the quasar itself. But you also notice, again, you're learning to become observers, there are radio photons here. The jet turns, and there's no X-ray. So that's interesting. These are non-thermal. This is non-thermal emission. We have electrons that are moving relativistically, spiraling around a magnetic field, giving us synchrotron radiation in the radio. And at some point, it hits something dense and turns, but you're still getting these low-energy photons coming from this radio emission, but we're not getting any high-energy photons anymore once we go around that corner. And when we first looked at this, we thought that the X-rays were scattered photons. If you interact a photon with the electrons from which it was produced, it can boost up the energy of that photon into the X-rays. It's called Compton scattering. You can do it similarly with photons coming from behind, from the cosmic microwave background. So we thought that was what the emission is. Now we're beginning to think it might actually be synchrotron itself, but with very, very high energy electrons, because we're not seeing them in the gamma rays, and we would expect to. But that's a complicated story. But research keeps moving on. But this was the beginning of multi-wavelength studies of AGN, or quasars, active galaxies. Here's another one. This is actually a much nearer by source. It's in a cluster of galaxies. And this is the X-ray picture. And this is a lot of hot gas, so sort of fuzzy structure. But in the core here, there's a jet. There it is. That's the quasar itself, and then this jet going on out in this direction with some hot spots, just like the last one. If we put the data, just line it up and be able to look at it in more detail, this is the radio image, again, with lots of more resolution than the X-ray image at the bottom. And this particular one has optical data from Hubble, has an optical jet as well. And you can see that the hot spots along this jet line up quite well, so you can take one hotspot and study it in the radio, the optical, and the X-ray, and really look at the physical conditions and what's going on there. So this is multi-wavelength studies of jets that we'd never done before. So we now have learned a lot more about jets with the X-ray and the radio and sometimes the optical to constrain what's going on. I couldn't resist showing you this one because if we look at the core, this is the quasar itself. This, you may remember, it was the first image of a black hole. This is M87. Very nearby active galaxy or quasar. And this was a few years ago now, maybe 5 years. This is 40 micro arc seconds across. It's 50,000 times higher resolution than we get with Chandra because they distributed telescopes, or there are telescopes, radio telescopes, all over the world, and they link them all together. And now your baseline is the diameter of the Earth. So you've got very, very high resolution. And this is the first time we actually imaged what we expected to see, which was the shadow of the black hole with lots of hot, again, non-thermal emission, because this is a radio observation, in a ring around it. Okay, we also have binary supermassive black holes, just like we have binary stars, we have binary galaxies. And so I'm going to move on to a couple of those now. This was the first one that we saw. The picture here is of a pair of galaxies that have come too close to one another and can't escape from one another now. In the red and the yellow, we've got the visible light picture. And so it probably was two spiral galaxies, but now they've come together and they're a mess. They've got spiral arms going all over the place. And we knew that there were two bright central clusters. We didn't know quite what they all were. We thought one of them was probably an active nucleus, but we didn't know about the other one. However, Chandra shows two X-ray sources. So we know now that these are two active, accreting supermassive black holes in this core. They're about 300 light years apart, and they will eventually merge because they slow one another down. in about 100 mega years in this case. This is a movie, and I should say that our outreach group produced beautiful graphics, which I'm using today. So those are the two galaxies come together. Now you can see these little accretion disks around black holes here. Sorry, I'm disturbing it. So they're just rotating like the moon and the Earth, orbit around one another. These are a bit more equal in size, probably, than the moon and the Earth. But it's the same principle. But eventually they'll come together. And when they do, this is what will happen, is they will merge. You'll get a bigger supermassive black hole. And you'll also see gravitational waves, because there's so much gravity involved in these supermassive black holes that you create waves in space due to gravity. And I'll come back to that in a minute. These are binary supermassive black holes. Other ones that we found look quite similar in a sense. You know, spiral arms going in the wrong directions, two bright X-ray central sources, same here. This is combined with ground-based optical data, and the X-rays again are in blue. We've also found a triple system now. This is the optical picture. You can see three bright spots on the right. And then the X-ray picture shows that they're all accreting supermassive black holes. So these are triples. These are all within 30,000 light years of one another. And they will merge more quickly because they're now interacting with, each one is interacting with two other supermassive black holes. Now, gravitational waves are another way to look at celestial sources that we haven't been able to use before. We can't see the ones that galaxy would find yet because they're very long wavelengths. But for about 40 years, we've been trying to build gravitational wave detectors on the Earth so that we can detect these things that we're expecting. And about in 2015, again, many of you will know, we detected our first, I'm not involved in it, but we as a community detected our first merging stellar mass black holes. So much smaller in terms of mass, but still black holes. And so you have a binary black hole, they merge together, and you get these gravitational waves that were finally detected by LIGO, which has two sites in Louisiana and Washington State. And also there's one in Italy. The Italians have one as well. And they're basically looking for masses that are very accurately placed to move, and they've got them in two arms. So if a gravitational wave comes through, those two masses will move differently. And if you have very, very accurate and very, very quiet, no trucks going by, etc., you might actually be able to measure them, and now we can. So from merging black holes, well, on the left, a simulation of two merging black holes and what they will do to all of the gas and the stars around them. This is actually emerging supermassive black holes, I suppose, because there are so much gas and stars around them. But they know what it should look like. We don't expect any electromagnetic signal, so no light is expected from merging black holes because the light can't escape. That's why they're called black holes. The escape velocity is faster than the speed of light. So we don't see any light from them. However, 2 years after that, and it's still, I think, the only one, they found a pair of merging neutron stars. So neutron stars you do see, and so we expect to see electromagnetic radiation from neutron stars that are merging. And LIGO and Virgo saw this source called, which is called GW for gravitational wave, 170817 for the 17th of August. No, yes, 17th of August. That's a UK-based date. That's weird. 170817, so in 2017. And LIGO detected this signal that was longer in time than when the stellar mass black holes merge. So they knew it was neutron stars. 2 seconds later, Fermi and Integral, which are both gamma ray, Fermi I talked about earlier, gamma ray telescopes up in space. One's ESA, one, the other is NASA. They both saw this very faint, short gamma ray burst. Just a burst of gamma rays. It lasts a second and goes away. It was very faint. They didn't think it was very exciting until they realized that LIGO had seen something and looked back and found this faint gamma ray burst that had happened 2 seconds later and realized it was probably the same source. So an optical counterpart was looked for, and people were ready all over the world with lists of galaxies and images of those galaxies, so that when something like this was found, they could go to their telescopes and just look from one galaxy to the next and try to find a bright source that shouldn't be there. Right? And they found them. They had to wait a few hours because it was light in the US, in the Americas at the time. This was in the Southern Hemisphere. So in South America, all the telescopes down there, as soon as it was dark, started going through these galaxies, different groups of people. And they found one that night. The picture I'm showing here is the Hubble picture, which is why it's so beautiful and so much detail. It's an elliptical galaxy, and the circled source with the black circle around it shouldn't be there. So they had found it. They then tracked it to see it fade. It was quite blue to begin with, and it got fainter and fainter and redder over about 2 weeks, and then it went behind the sun. But it was already so faint that actually we wouldn't be able to get much more. In the X-ray, we didn't see it right away. This is actually quite an interesting experience. I was the director at the time, and I was on my way with a bunch of my colleagues to Sun Valley, Idaho, for the solar eclipse. You might remember the date. It was August 2017. And we started getting all these pages coming in from three different groups of people who had approved programs to look at gravitational wave sources once we found them. It's called a target of opportunity. And they all wanted to look first. There were three of them, so I had to navigate between these three teams. We looked 2 days later and didn't see anything in this circle. There's nothing there. There's one X-ray photon here, which is just background. Then we discussed, should we look at it again, and who should look at it next? And we looked after 9 days, so 7 days later, and here was the source. So this actually immediately told us that we've got a jet, but it's not pointing right towards us. When a jet points towards us with relativistic electrons, it's very, very bright. But as soon as it points away, it's much fainter. So that's why it was a faint gamma ray burst. So it's an off-axis jet. What else did I want to say here? So the jet gives us X-ray and radio emission, and that continued to brighten. But then, because it was behind the sun, the only thing that could we could only observe it in the radio, which you can observe during the day. So we watched it for the next 3 months, and then Chandra was able to go back, and Chandra, the X-rays had brightened along with the radio. So it's definitely synchrotron radiation, non-thermal radiation, coming from a jet. One other thing I was going to say was the optical spectra that were taken of this, what's called a kilonova, when these neutron stars merged, all this material got thrown out, showed signs of R process elements. So these are elements heavier than iron that can't be made by fusion. They need what's called rapid neutron capture, can create these heavier elements. So this was proof of something that was expected to happen in this situation, well, had been predicted. Don't always find that that is what happens. So that was exciting too. So to explain what I mean, I should probably look at the time. 8:30. I should probably make this the last topic. To explain how this is working, an off-axis jet, so I talked about these jets that are coming out. So in this diagram here, we've got these two neutron stars that merged. They create shock waves, and part of their own material gets blown out and anything around. And that's what caused what we called the kilonova, which was the optical signal we saw that was blue and then became very red and very faint in about 2 weeks. But we also have these bipolar jets, just like in the quasars, but on a much smaller scale. And they move out very rapidly, relativistically. And if you're in line, they're very bright. But we were slightly out of line, so this is where Chandra was, and it was seeing the edge of the jet. As the jet moves out, it expands. So we didn't see it right away. We saw it when it expanded into our line of sight, and that's the purple here. And here's the light curve, so all you need to know is the red dots go up and then come down. And the purple is telling you what we were looking through. So we're looking through the purple as it was going up, And then when the jet had expanded enough that Chandra, still in the same position, was looking down the center part of the jet, it becomes yellow here, that's where it peaks. And then all we see is that that jet keeps expanding and gets fainter. So we've been tracking it ever since. And these are the latest light curves. We tracked it in the radio and the X-ray. But in the last year, the radio is giving us upper limits, and the X-ray is the only thing that we see. So right down here, the X-ray, as you can see, these points are a little high. They're higher than what we're expecting, or what it was doing before. So this is, it's getting fainter because that material that was in a jet has now, in this different rendition, is blue. It doesn't look like a jet anymore. It's spread out, but you're still seeing some emission from it. So it's a lot fainter. But we're seeing something else as well. Because that's fainter, we've found another X-ray component. It's coming from one of two places. Either the central neutron star merger, which could be a black hole, we think it probably is accreting material from around it, and it's become bright, like the quasars in the middle of galaxies, only on a smaller scale, and that would give us X-rays. It's also possible that this expanding kilonova, which will keep expanding just like the supernova remnant does, is giving us X-ray emission as well, because it's shocking material around it. And we're now seeing it because the jet isn't giving us so much X-ray, so we can see the fainter emission. We don't know which it is yet. And now the radio can't track it, but we're still tracking it with the X-rays. We're observing it about once a year, these same teams that started doing this. But they have to reapply every year. I think they can reapply and get observations for 2 or 3 years. But it gives other people a chance to get in the mix. Okay, could I show you one more thing?
Yeah.
They are nice pictures, aren't they? God's universe on display. Galaxies like to be together just like stars are. Again, it's all due to gravity. And so we have clusters of galaxies which could have anything from 100 to 1,000 galaxies that are held together by their gravity. And we call them clusters of galaxies. Again, very simple English to understand what we're seeing. What I'm going to show you now is, in the optical, what the cluster looks like. This is called the brightest cluster galaxy. It's like a spider. It has all these filaments of star formation and lots of galaxies around it. This is the Perseus cluster, which is fairly near to us, so it's quite big on the sky. Now I'm merging from the optical visible light picture to the X-ray. And this is the Chandra picture of this source. You still see some of the stars, some of the galaxies in the X-rays, but most of them have gone away. They're not bright X-ray sources. But look at all this gas. Very, very hot gas that we didn't see in the optical picture at all. So only in the X-ray can we see this hot gas. And we knew we would see this hot gas. We know it's there because there's too much gravity. Too much gravity is needed to keep those galaxies together. So there's a lot more mass in those clusters than we can see in the optical light. There's 10 times more mass in this hot X-ray gas than there is in those galaxies, those thousands of galaxies. There's also 10 times more than the X-ray gas in what we call dark matter, but I won't have time to talk about that today. But so this X-ray gas fills all the space. We expected we'd be able to see this, measure its temperature. It would be boring, smooth distribution of gas. And this is what we found. Again, it's a mess. It's not a complete mess because we understand now what's going on. But it's really exciting and interesting, and it's completely changed our view of clusters of galaxies and indeed galaxies themselves, because galaxies look like these clusters, but on a smaller scale. So in the middle of this, in that spidery-looking thing, which is NGC 1275, it has a supermassive black hole. It's a radio source. It has jets. We didn't see that because we were just looking in the visible light. But it's right here. You do see it in the X-rays. And those jets are going in this direction and this direction. And there you see holes in the X-ray gas. There's no orange emission there, right? their holes. So those jets are pushing away the gas and creating voids. Well, voids in terms of the X-ray gas, but you've got radio emission coming from there. So the plasma that gives you those radio jets and is spiraling along the magnetic fields is filling those holes. Because it's doing that, it's pushing the material away, the hot gas away, it creates shocks. So you get these bright shocks here on either side of the voids. And you get more. Here's another one and another one. So you can see where there was a jet before going in a different direction a long time ago, and those voids are still just moving out through that gas. So we have a fossil record of the activity of that supermassive black hole giving us jets. And that's what all this structure in here is. On top of that, we get what are called cold fronts. Just like cold fronts in our atmosphere, these are cold fronts, where the brightness changes, the temperature changes very quickly. We couldn't have resolved this with anything but Chandra. These sharp edges, they're very, very sharp edges. And we think that what happened there is that another cluster came by, and the gravitational force between the two just made the gas swing around. So if you think of your wine glass with some wine in it, it's not quite the same, but if you do this with it, wine will sort of swing around the edge of the glass. And there's a similar thing happening here, only as a result of another cluster going by at some point. So these are cold fronts, and there are several of those too. So this was the birth of really understanding how clusters work. And this one is smaller, it's further away, so it's smaller, so we can see the whole thing at once in one image. Here, the red is the radio jet, so now we're seeing that plasma. The blue is the X-ray, sorry, the color coding is different here, and the white is the galaxies. So again, we have a quasar in the middle sending out radio jets. It bends at some point but keeps going. And you can see there's not much blue right around these radio jets. It's pushed a hole. And we think what's happening is the jets heat up the gas. The gas gets hot. It stops forming stars because it only forms stars as it cools. It stops flowing into the center. Eventually, that supermassive black hole has no more material coming in to feed it, so it stops being active. And then everything cools down and stars begin to form. So it's like we call it a feedback loop. It's the same as the thermostat in your house. When it gets hot, the thermostat turns off. The house cools down. When it gets below a certain temperature, the thermostat turns on. It's the same kind of process, but on a completely huge scale. But it regulates the growth of the black hole and the growth of stars in these galaxies. So I'll end there, but I'll quickly go to our astronauts, just so you can see them. This is Eileen Collins, who is the commander. This is Katie Coleman, who was our mission specialist for Chandra. This is Steve Hawley, who was an astrophysicist and an astronaut, and now an astrophysicist again. He also went up on two or three of the Hubble missions that you can actually go and service Hubble because it's only 100 miles up. Can't do that with Chandra, but he's been on some of those. Jeff Ashby was the pilot, and this is an ESA astronaut, Michelle Tognini. This is on the shuttle, and this banner or flag behind them, they took up with them. They brought back down, and it's hanging in our control center in Cambridge, Massachusetts, which is rather nice. And then they come back and visit us. So here they are again. And me. And me again. And there's some pictures. So thank you for listening.
Well, am I working? Yes, I am. Thank you very much. It's just amazing. When the psalmist said that the heavens declare the glory of the Lord and the skies proclaim his handiwork, I don't think he had a clue, really, did he? It's just how complex. And, it's amazing. Now, there's time for some questions. Kate, could I pass you a microphone to take around for the questions? Let me just find another mic whilst I think about it.
By the way, you'll spot some of the sources you know in here. It's Crab Nebula. There's that merging black hole system. And here's Cassie. Yeah. Sorry.
If you'd like to put your hand up, well, there's one Gordon's got a question over here already, I can see.
Thank you very much indeed. My mind is blown. I don't know whether any jets coming from it, but certainly there's some and some the radio waves coming out, but rather confused. A very simple question. What is gravity?
What is gravity?
What is gravity?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, it's a simple question. It's not an easy answer. But it keeps us on the Earth, right? I mean, without gravity, we wouldn't be here. It's holding us down. It's just the force of attraction between matter, one piece of matter and another piece of matter.
What's it made of?
What's it? Well, forces
he's,
aren't
he's
made of
he's being provocative
anything.
Here on purpose.
Yeah. Forces aren't made of anything, right? They're just forces.
But yeah, it is true.
It's the result of mass.
It hasn't been integrated into the model of all the other electromagnetic radiation and things.
No,
so it's a weird one.
That's true. It is a weird one.
Yeah.
But it wins. Gravity wins in the end. So maybe we should try to understand it better.
There's one behind you, I think, Kate.
Hi, thank you for your amazing talk. What made you go into astrophysics?
Ah, yes. I was telling this story at supper time. I did physics and maths A-level. Oh, I can speak to British people and they know what I mean when I say that. It wasn't true in the States. And music, as an aside. And we used to have to read articles from Scientific American. I don't know whether you all did too when you were in high school. And I must have read something that sparked my interest, because I'm sure it wasn't the Kepler's laws that we did as part of the course, which are interesting and all about gravity, but not fascinating in the way many other things are. But what really cemented it for me was I read Fred Hoyle's Nature of the Universe. But I must have been interested before that, because otherwise I wouldn't have read it. My father had the book. He's an engineer, not a physicist, but he had that book. And it's about continuous creation, which even then probably wasn't a valid theory. It was a long time ago, but not that long. But the whole idea that tiny little human beings on this nondescript planet around a normal sun in this huge universe could even contemplate understanding what the universe was like just amazed me. I mean, continuous creation is sort of continuing to create matter to explain what we're seeing when we see the distribution of the sources out there. And we know because of the Big Bang, we now have the cosmic microwave background, that that isn't the way it works. But Fred Hoyle had this really engaging style, so it was just fascinating to read. It was easy to read. And just the whole idea of learning how the universe worked and things out there, so far away and so different, so very, very different from conditions on Earth. That we could try to understand it just really fascinated me. So, and I'm still doing it, so I guess it still does.
And there was a couple over the other side.
Mm-hmm. Before I got blitzed with your wonderful images, my mind went back to the beginning, and we saw Chandra leaving the launch vehicle. What mm-hmm. propels it?
At that point, when it was leaving, it was just let go,
But then you've got to direct it. So.
But yes, then we had a...
What's the nature of the propulsion?
Well, we use... what's it called? Not very good at all. Hydrazine.
Hydrazine.
I mean, we still have quite a lot of it. We use it also to control the attitude of the spacecraft. We had a big rocket. Sorry?
Are they hydrogen ions?
Hydrazine, I think, is the...
Hydrazine,
the chemical.
Yeah. And so we burn that to get us into the right orbit. And we still have more of that fuel. So actually, from the point of view of fuel, Chandra can go for a long time.
One there, and then I think John had one at the front as well.
Thank you for a very interesting lecture. Just one question quickly. Can you just explain the jets, how they work and what they consist of? Those jets. Yes, thank you.
Yes, well, we don't really know what launches them. We still don't know what launches them. Sorry, I'm moving too much. But there are strong magnetic fields that probably get wrapped around because of the supermassive black hole and the accretion disk that's spinning around it. The supermassive black hole is probably spinning too. So those magnetic field lines will be the accretion disk is moving around in this direction, so they'll tend to be at the poles. So you end up with these poles. And then any kind of plasma that's around can get sucked in. Charged particles can get sucked into the magnetic field. And because it's all so powerful, many of them are relativistic. We now, because of Chandra, think that we know the structure of those, which is it's called a spine sheath. You have a very, very relativistic. That relativistic means moving close to the speed of light, so getting to be the fastest you can. And these are electrons and probably protons as well, spiraling very, very fast out along those magnetic field lines. And that's what gives you synchrotron radiation. Where was I going after that? Yes, so they just keep doing that as long as all that energy is around. Yeah.
The gravitational signal arrived, but the light was 2 seconds later. Why doesn't it arrive at the same time?
Ah, now that's a good question. It wasn't very long after that, yeah. No, it wasn't the same. And actually, they do understand that. I'm not sure I do, though, now I think about it. Well, yes, it's probably because the neutron stars themselves merge, right? And that produces a gravitational wave which then comes towards us at the same speed as light, presumably. I'm not an expert on gravitational waves. But then the X-rays and the gamma rays were coming from the jet, so it would take a little bit of time for the jet to get started. Yeah.
The northern lights, do they emit X-rays on Earth?
Yes, I believe so.
Okay, thank you.
I'm not sure it's kind of hard to observe the Earth because there's too many other X-rays around. Other light around.
There's a couple of questions here in this row. And you're next, yes? It's one there and then you. Yep.
Have you had a chance to get the James Webb telescope onto the same sources yet?
Probably. I haven't personally, though. Not directly involved in James Webb. I know a lot of people who are, obviously, even people in my own department. I'm sure they're looking at supernova remnants. I know they're looking at exoplanets, which we don't... we do look at exoplanets, planets around stars, because some of them get blown away from the X-rays from the stars, so that's important to do. I don't know about particular sources yet. Probably should look for that.
Fascinating account. I'm just wondering, you're saying, looking at clusters of galaxies, and were you saying that there's a supermassive black hole holding them together in the same way you've got a black hole at the centre of a galaxy?
Yeah, sort of. Those sources will have very big supermassive black holes in their cores. Those galaxies, they get incredibly big because this is in the centre of the potential well of that cluster. So anything that's hanging around will tend to fall that way. So these are called brightest cluster galaxies, and they're the biggest galaxies in the universe. So yes, but there's also just the gravity of the whole cluster that holds it together as well. So it's a lot of gravity going on.
Can I? Have you got one back there?
One at the back.
Yeah, okay. Where am I? Oh, right at the back. There you go.
Two at the back.
I wondered, with your links to the University of Bristol, whether you or the Chandra team ever used the Coldrick telescope on top of the physics building.
My collaborator Mark Birkinshaw does. He was responsible for it being there, I understand. It's been out of commission for a while, but they're bringing it back into commission. I'm not sure exactly what the reason was, but I haven't used it myself.
Is it perhaps just too small for the sort of...
Oh, for these sources, it would be too small. But they do use it definitely for student projects, and I think some research, yeah. Yes, go ahead.
This might be a bit of a controversial and off-topic question, but do you think that Elon Musk's projects have any direction or are realistic in any way?
Sorry, I didn't hear it all.
Do you think that... sorry, I have a cold. Do you think that Elon Musk's projects are realistic or have any direction in any way?
Elon Musk. I think he's a little crazy myself, but but if you have lots of crazy ideas, some of them will work. And you know, they're taking rockets. They're working with NASA, and the rockets are going up from SpaceX, and he started all that. So, yeah, maybe maybe the most brilliant people are a bit crazy. But, you know, sending a car out, was it the red sports car, probably a Tesla, out into space seemed very crazy to me. It seemed like a waste of fuel, but it's a stunt.
Oh, right, and then there's one over here.
You're obviously looking out onto an absolutely terrifying universe. What about our own galaxy? Do we have sort of pinpoints of radiation coming that we might go through that might cause devastation on the Earth? Or can't we see our own galaxy properly?
Yeah, well, we can't actually, but there are lots of ways that we've figured out the structure of our galaxy. We know it quite well, but we can't see it in... Like, if we look at Andromeda, we see a big, which is our neighbour, we see a big, beautiful spiral galaxy, and it's much harder because we're inside this one. But it's not really a big, violent universe everywhere. Most of it is just empty space. Vacuum's much more vacuum-like than we could ever make on Earth, right? There's not much there. So the chances of the Earth or this part of our galaxy going through some stream of charged particles are very small. They're not zero, though. So it's definitely possible. I mean, we know we've had meteors come down and hit the Earth's surface. I mean, it's something we need to think about. But in general, most of the universe is empty.
But presumably our own galaxy... Because we're going around, what, 30, 40 million years? I don't know how long it takes, but there's a black hole at the centre.
Yes, there
and
is.
And presumably there's radiation spilling out from that.
No, it's not an active black hole, though it wouldn't be that different if it was, I suppose.
Right.
It's a fairly small one. It's about a million solar masses, whereas most of them are more like 10, 100 million, or even 1,000 million, a billion. It has been active in the past. We actually see structures that must be the result of jets that came out in the past, but we're not seeing much from it now. We just see it bursts of radiation every now and then. So we do monitor it. But there is an image of what's called Sagittarius Star, which is the center of the galaxy. That's where the supermassive black hole is. There's an image that the EHT made of that as well, which looks very like the M87 one. But it was much more complicated to get because it keeps pulsing. You know, it's not the M87 is an active supermassive black hole, so you've got a fairly steady light source. But with the one in the middle of the Milky Way, it lights up every now and then. So they can add together all that material, but because it's varying, it was harder for them to figure out what the structure was. But the result looks very similar to that in M87.
Can I bring it over now, please? There. I think we'll make this the last question from the floor. I want to end up with a question myself, so I'm going to be very selfish.
Yes.
This telescope must be continually having to be reorientated.
Yes.
Because of its orbit and because different people want to look at different things.
Yes.
In different directions.
Yes.
Once you set it to turn, you've got to then stop it turning. So you've got to use your energy to get it to rotate.
Yeah, we
and
have
then
react-
energy to stop it rotating.
Yeah, yeah.
So where does the fuel for that come from? Where does the energy come from? Because the hydrazine will run out, surely.
No, we're not running out of hydrazine. We've
no,
got
but
mass-
are they using hydrazine
yes.
in order to do these twists and
yes.
twiddles?
Yes, yes.
Really?
Absolutely, yeah. Mm. We have reaction wheels and we use the momentum. You know, you can be quite clever about it and use the build-up of momentum in one direction to help you go in the okay. other direction. So the engineers that work on Chandra are very clever in terms of figuring out how to conserve what we have. But yes, that's what we use.
Thank you.
And of course, there's no resistance in space, so you don't need much energy to move things around.
No, that's true. Yeah.
I'm going to finish with one question, if I may, rather than go to the floor again. And that's that. We're trying to encourage women into science, and you've obviously made it to the top. Did you find it quite a difficult journey, or did you not? Because I think a lot of women in science have found it hard work, if I may put it that way.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think it is hard work. I hadn't ever dreamed of being a director of an observatory. I just kind of ended up there. I mean, I obviously applied for the job and got it, but I'd been working for Chandra for a while. It is definitely hard for women to progress in the same way that men do. And a lot of it is just 1,000 little cuts. You know? You aren't allowed to ask that question, or somebody interrupts you, or they don't read your paper, they read somebody else's paper because they know that person better, and that person's probably a man because they know each other better. So there, even if there isn't any direct, and I don't think I had any real direct, you know, no one stood in my way and told me I can't do physics or whatever that got in my way. I was very lucky from that point of view. But even with that, it's just a much harder
track. Do you think it's getting easier?
There are certainly a lot more young women. You know, when I go to American Astronomical Society meeting, there are a lot more young women. But we still lose them along the way. And then, of course, there's life. Life happens. You get married, you have kids. You know, if you're pregnant and you're having a baby and you're feeding the baby, you can't do your astronomy the same way you did before, at least for a while. And it doesn't happen to men in the same way. Obviously, they're getting more involved in the childcare, and that's helping. But it's still basically the woman's job. So it is a lot harder. There's just a lot more things that can happen that get in your way. And so, yeah, we need to keep working at it.
Well, thank you very much. I think with the number of questions, you can see you've engaged people very well. So many, many thanks. I'm sure you'll be around for a few minutes if there are any very burning questions. But for now, let's say a big thank you.
Thank you very much.